hours, and I'm rambling around the subject of the Chakravartin Raja, the wheel-turning monarch, and using that as a way to explore some Buddhist ideals connected with government. I'm not making a very sophisticated or detailed or applied exploration. I'm simply trying to draw out some principles that probably fairly easily can be applied in the situations that we confront, even though those situations are usually far more complex than they would have been at the time of the Buddha. So the ideal of the Chakravartin, chakra means wheel, vartin means turning, the wheel-turning king. We can take king to be a term for the government, if you like, in a general way. It goes back to the early suttas, those of you who know the Pali Canon. There are a couple of suttas in Digha Nikaya, which is the first collection of the Pali Canon. They may be a bit later than the time of the Buddha, but they're certainly founded on the Buddha's own basic teaching. They are connected with one of these very interesting instructional stories that the Buddha tells from time to time. He communicates as much through images and myth as through more worked out conceptual expressions, which he certainly does do in astonishing clarity and in a way that is easily relatable today. He tells the story of a wheel-turning monarch in the distant past, a king who is, as it were, elected because the people find that in the state of nature, to use an early European Enlightenment term, in the state of nature, there's conflict and war and violence and crime. So the people choose somebody to keep order. That the original conception of kingship is connected simply with that, keeping order, ordering society. But this king who's mentioned in the suttas rules with great righteousness, and at a certain point some of his people come to him and say that above the palace there's a great golden wheel in the sky, as it were. In some depictions it's got 24 spokes, in some it's got 16, in some it's got 8, probably according to taste. And the king, who knows the ancient law, realizes that this means he is ruling righteously, that he is a wheel-turning monarch. So let's just pause for a moment. I didn't go into this very much when we first talked about it, but just pause for a moment. What on earth does this mean? What is this wheel hovering in the sky? Has anybody seen it above the Palace of Westminster recently? Have you ever seen it there? Obviously, it's a myth. Well, I presume it's a myth. Maybe it's a myth with also some practical exemplification. I'm not close to that. But the king, when he sees that chakra, that wheel, above his palace, is greatly gladdened. It sort of confirms his own righteousness as a ruler. And he goes up to the roof of the palace and he starts worshipping the wheel. He starts bowing down in front of it, he makes offerings to it, and he pours water on it as a sort of a cleansing of it, in a welcoming gesture, not to clean it, but to representing his honour for it. So, what does this mean? This worship of the wheel. What is the Dhamma that the wheel embodies? It's a bit odd for us, isn't it, to think of worshipping a symbol. But it's interesting, in the early scriptures, or the early archaeology, reveals that there were no Buddha images to begin with. They didn't come for about 400 years. So if you see early sites, early Buddhist sites, there's no Buddhas represented. For instance, I've just been in India and I visited while I was there our retreat center near Pune, Bhaja, which has some very old Buddhist caves there. And these caves are focused upon the Chaitya Hall, the main shrine hall. And at the end of the shrine hall, where you'd expect to see a Buddha image, you see a great stone cylinder with a dome on top of it and a sort of structure on top of that, a stupa. It's amazing when you're there. I went with a party of Buddhists and we did puja there. There's a tremendous presence to this this stupa. It feels alive, the best way you can put it. It seems as if for the early Buddhists, the Buddha could not be represented, not because it was wrong to represent him, as you get in Christian iconoclasm and Islam and so forth. It's not, as it were, sinful to represent the Buddha, but it's just sort of impossible to represent what he really is, because he's not just a human figure. He's represents a something that is completely transcendent. So the symbol of the stupa embodies something more than personal, if you see what I mean. It's not personal in the sense of a merely human personality, but it's something that a human being can attain, but represents something more than a human being. So the wheel is often used as a symbol for the Buddha, especially when it's connected with the first teaching, the Dhammacakra Pravartana at Saranath. Even at Saranath, you have a big wheel of the Dhamma on a plinth there. So it represents the Buddha, but it represents in a way even more than the Buddha as a human personality. It represents the Buddha as the embodiment of ultimate reality, of reality itself, of the Dharma. The word Dharma comes from a root meaning that which holds up, that which upholds, that which supports. So it comes to mean, and especially in Buddhism, it comes to mean the underlying substructure of reality on which our normal experience, of which our normal experience is a distortion. It comes to represent things as they really are, beyond our ego-based interpretations of them. So the Buddha is embodied by the wheel, but in a way he also himself reveres, worships the Dhamma. We find this in some of the suttas. He speaks of revering and relying upon the Dhamma. So it represents a principle that, well, principle is too dead a word. It represents a living reality that is felt, experienced, which is not impersonal and it's not narrowly personal. I'm trying to think of how one could get some feeling for what it means. And the closest I could get to it was thinking of the experience that I probably quite common, certainly one that I have, of conflict. A conflict between my immediate self-interest and my sense of values and ideals. You know, for instance, quite recently I found myself in a position that somebody had to leave a very important task. It was in India. He was taking on a very, very important task, and he became quite ill, had to leave India, come back to Britain. And it was brutally obvious that I was the person who had the qualifications, so to speak, to take it on. And I really didn't want to. I watched in horrified fascination this sort of struggle going on within me, this urge for a quiet and easy life, and you know, I'd already formed some. Surya Gupta's nodding. I hope she hasn't got some sense of this. She probably has. Actually, I got some things I wanted to follow through. I wanted to do, but I could see that this task was really, really needed doing. That I was at least the best qualified, perhaps in certain sense, the only person qualified to do it at that particular time. And after time, others can do. But I just watched this sort of struggle going on within me. I almost stood aside and watched it. This quite personal sort of desire for what I wanted, and this strong sense, well, this is what I must do. Not in an oppressive sense, not that some, you know, heavy-handed, you know, cosmic judge was sort of saying, thou shalt be damned unless. Wasn't like that at all. It was my own sense of values, my own sense of ideals. I was going to say forced, but it's not that. It meant I couldn't neglect it. Of course, I took it on, being a dutiful sort, and I've certainly never regretted it. But what I'm trying to get at is a hiatus within one that I'm sure everybody will have some version of, whether it's on a small scale, when you know, you could sort of fiddle the books, or you know, cheat in one way or another. Nobody will notice. It doesn't matter. What I call the morality of the private moment. In other words, nobody's watching, so you could get away with it. Well, we say conscience, but conscience is a bit of a dirty word. I think it's actually a very good word, but it's become a sort of a superego, a kind of Freudian superego that suppresses you. But actually, conscience in Buddhism is the best word to translate it would be smriti or sati, which means awareness, mindfulness. So your conscience is actually your mindfulness of a reality that goes beyond yourself, that means you must give up what might be a more self-interested or even unskillful desire. Do you get something of what I mean? This is, of course, on a much larger scale than that. It's in revering the Dhamma, as it were, pouring pure water on the Dhamma wheel and making offerings to the Dhamma wheel, represents one's commitment to setting your own personal interests aside in reverence to, in service to, some universal reality that transcends you, transcends all. So the idea of the Dhammacakra Pravartin Raja is the idea of somebody who rules on the basis of that much greater response, a response to something much greater, which is not forced, not thought, it's felt, as well as maybe given words, but it's something that's an immediate response. This is the reality, and this is what must be done. And that's what the wheel represents. It doesn't represent some literal something that is revered. It's in the Buddhist context, it's not something that can be pinned down in any way. For those of your interest, a very, very good article on reverence by our teacher, Sangharakshita. You'll find it on his website, Reflections on the Gaurava Sutta. Gaurava means reverence. He's talking about the Buddha's own reverence. He talks about the Buddha's reverence teaching us how to live. The Buddha lives revering. He's not revering something. It's as if his whole attitude is one of reverence, of receptivity, of giving up self to something greater. Something greater. We have to use those words, but it's not that there is a something separate from him upon which he relies and to which he reveres. The same with you've got the Dhamma Chakra there, but it represents something that's not a something. I better hasten on. So the Chakravartin Raja represents somebody who governs, who rules on the basis of a reality that goes beyond the personal, and who sets aside his or her personal interests in order to serve that ideal, and that ideal itself is the ideal of serving his or her people. So the first duty of the Chakravartin Raja, going back to the original sutta, is to revere, reverence, respect the Dhamma, to accept the Dhamma as master. So in other words, put it beyond, above oneself. Interestingly, I mentioned as the generations went by, and each inheritor of the kingdom learned these principles and put them into practice, and the Dhamma Chakra came back. It disappears, then it comes back when they live righteously. But along came a new king who didn't do this and relied upon his own ideas, ruled in accordance with his own ideas. This is very interesting indeed. In other words, ruled from a merely rational basis, therefore to some extent an egoistic basis, from the basis merely of his own understanding, without acknowledging that there is that which goes beyond that understanding. It's interesting, the Dhamma, in various places the Buddha, is a formula that he repeats it again and again, the Dhamma is deep, very deep, gambhirang, atakavacharo, which means beyond the reach of reason. So you can't think the Dhamma. So if you try to think, you try to rule from thinking, your rule will be as narrow as your mind, so to speak. If you set aside mere thinking, you let your thinking serve this principle that goes beyond reason, then the kingdom will prosper. So on the basis of this reverence, the Chakravartin Raja protects citizens. And it goes through a sort of formulaic list of all the sections of society. In fact, it goes through the castes, interestingly enough, but they're sort of more presented as different specializations rather than different hierarchical orders. And it goes on to include animals and birds. So the Raja protects all life within the kingdom. His third duty is to prevent crime. Prevent crime, punish those who commit crime, and especially to make sure that those who do commit crime are enabled to learn, to grow. Interestingly, I mentioned a number of times, under protecting citizens, one of the things he does to protect citizens is give property. So to minimize the inequalities and the poverty that lead to crime. Tough on crime and the causes of crime. That's back a generation, isn't it? But then it gets very interesting. He honours, I've just put a shorthand phrase, spiritual seekers, those who live a full-time life of spiritual quest. And it's clear from the context that includes everybody, not just the Buddhists, Shramanas and Brahmanas, the two major different currents of spiritual quest within ancient India, but you can easily apply it within our own context. And I repeatedly added artists to the list because that's one of the ways in which the spiritual quest has been carried out. in the Western tradition. So the king honours such spiritual seekers, and in other places it says supports them and protects them all, so long as they adhere to the principles of ethics and of especially of non-violence. And he tries to learn what is skillful and unskillful. He uses the spiritual seekers to clarify what the Dhamma is and how to revere it. And so you have a very important sort of equation which constitutes the ideal Buddhist society. You have the government, which is based upon Dharma, upon this principle that goes beyond self, a moral principle, a spiritual principle that goes beyond self-interest, and that emerges from the nature of things, which especially as realized by the Buddha, realized through direct experience, not hammered out with reason, as the texts say. So the government, and the government in our context probably includes both the political leaders and the civil service, the administration, because that's a key element of government. It's a very interesting question in itself, the role of a civil service in a polity. And very interesting in India, the civil service is still highly respected, whilst politicians are often known to be corrupt, but the civil service is relatively free from that sort of corruption, not entirely. So you have the government with both its branches, the legislative and executive, if you like, and the judicial function. Then you have the citizens, and then you have the spiritual seekers. And if the relationship between them all is right, then you have Dhammarajya, Rajya being the abstract word for government. Dhammarajya is the rule of the Dhamma, or government of the Dhamma. Of course, in the context of a modern democracy, into the system must be injected the citizen, as to some extent having some role in the choice of government. It's the citizens who choose the government, or at least through the processes of election, their votes contribute to that choice. So the citizens themselves are a key factor in the whole equation. And if the citizens are not revering the Dhamma, then they will choose a government that is not revering the Dhamma, and the whole system will be corrupted. And I mentioned yesterday Dr. Ambedkar, the great Indian leader and leader of the downtrodden untouchables under the caste system, and the chief architect of the Indian constitution. He was deeply disillusioned with the constitution because he realized that constitutions are only as good as the people. They're only as good as the people who elect and the people who are elected. And so it puts the task of creating Dhammarajya, makes it much bigger task. In former times, in the time of the Buddha, and really until the 19th century, pretty much, if you could convert the rulers, you could convert the people. There's a famous principle, the Peace of Westphalia, if you remember, 1648, of course you all remember, the principle of cuius regio, eius religio. Have I got my Latin tenses right? Anyway, he who rules, his is the religion. So the patchwork quilt of the princely states of Germany at that time, it was decided that whoever was the prince, well, he could decide whether they were Catholics, Lutherans, or Calvinists. So it was sort of nominally at least, reasonably easy to enforce a religious perspective through the conversion of the king. And until Buddhism died out in India, its fortunes almost entirely depended upon the kings, the monarchs. If the kings were Buddhist or favourable to Buddhism, or at least pluralistic in their outlook, then Buddhism flourished. If they did not, then often Buddhism was suppressed. And we know that there was a forcible suppression of Buddhism in India by non-Buddhist monarchies. And it's probably more to do with the fading of Buddhism in India than with the invasion of the Muslims. That didn't help, but it was more a deliberate suppression by non-Buddhist kings. So, for better or worse, and perhaps in a sense it's for better, we can no longer think simply of converting the governors. It's very good if the governors have some Buddhist influence, or some dhammic influence, whether it's in Buddhist form or not, but some moral or spiritual perspective that is more than merely egoistic human. If that can be present amongst rulers, that's a very good thing. And it's very significant, I think, that quite recently some of our order members, and with other Buddhists from other traditions, have been involved in a House of Commons or House of Parliament mindfulness group, which is attended by a really quite large number of parliamentarians. I can't remember the numbers now, but really quite significant numbers. Maybe 20% or something like that. So that's pretty significant, actually. What good it does remains to be seen. But it still leaves the question of the wider population, which, after all, in the end, very easily becomes disillusioned with the political class if the political class is not sufficiently in tune. This is what we're going through at the moment, isn't it? An upsurge of populism, because people are fed up with the political class, for better or worse. Whether that's right or wrong is difficult to say. The overall state of the populace and their understanding of things, their moral standards, strongly affect the kind of government that emerges. And again, this is notable in Hungary, where I spend some time amongst, as I've said, amongst Roma gypsies, who are very, very worried indeed about the current political situation, which is right-wing, you know, to a degree that we don't recognise in Britain, if you see what I mean, largely in the mainstream, which is very worrying to them. It's racist, and it's overtly racist in its outlook. And it's what actually most people think. It emerges out of the general population. It's a very small liberal population, mainly in Budapest, often Jewish, but the general population, they have these sort of attitudes. So the government represents those attitudes. And what Dr. Ambedkar was saying was, you can have the best constitution in the world, but if the people who are using that constitution are not themselves morally inspired, the system itself will be corrupt. So how to affect things, how to change things, how to bring about the kind of moral and spiritual revolution that is required in order to bring us closer and closer to Dhammarajya. I don't mean a Buddhist government. I'm not putting it in, you know, those labels, as it were, but a government that is subservient to supra-personal influences. In whatever terms those might be expressed. What is the role of these people, the spiritual seekers? Here, the Dhammarajya is seeking out the spiritual seekers and getting their advice and trying to learn from them, those who have renounced the worldly life to some extent and therefore have no dog in the fight, to use the technical term. They have no self-interest. They they're not particularly concerned about what decisions the government makes in a narrowly personal sense. So they are, as it were, a little bit above it. This is, for instance, why Pope Gregory enforced clerical celibacy, so that the priests would not have a stake in civil society. We know it didn't altogether work out, but maybe for some time it did. So that they were genuinely able to stand above and aside from worldly concerns and offer some guidance. And perhaps the monasteries would have done that while they were really alive, before they became corrupt and so on. But a good society needs individuals who are dedicated to a moral and spiritual ideal, and who are trying to lessen their attachment to the world and worldly things. And it's good for society because they provide an example of living for, well, we're here calling it the Dhamma, living for principles that go beyond personal interest. Society needs visibly individuals and collections, communities of individuals who live for something more than mere survival, live for something more than worldly success and achievement. If it does not have them and it does not offer them an honourable place, it's very, very difficult for government to be anything more than, in a democracy, the triumph of a certain majority over certain minorities, minority interests, or even minority communities in more pluralistic societies like India, or even in Hungary, and maybe to some extent here, a number of different cultures living side by side. And if there's a dominant culture which captures the power, they rule in their own interest, to disastrous effects in the 20th century. It was never to be forgotten that Hitler was voted into power. Mussolini was voted into power. Hitler's sway lasted until the Russian campaign began to fail dismally. But his power, his popularity was almost universal until that point. The same with Mussolini. They were voted into power because they represented the mood of the masses, as it were. And of course, they manipulated the mood of the masses really pretty skillfully, which is another complicating factor that I can't really build into all of this. But if you have a body of men and women who don't have too big a stake in the worldly life, and who are trying to live for something more than material success, the narrow pleasures of physical existence, and so forth, and who are not committed to any particular group, who don't identify themselves with one section of society over another, then you have some influence upon the larger society, and when the larger society is at all open to it, some means of elevating the larger society. It's very important that a sangha, in the Buddha's understanding of it, to join the sangha, you leave behind your old group identity. In the Pali Canon, that's talked of in terms of leaving behind your caste identity. When you become a member of the Sangha, you're no longer a Brahmin or Kshatriya or a Shudra or whatever. You just become a Shakyaputra, a son or daughter of the Shakyan, of the Buddha. And that's the that is the principle of leaving behind group identities, whether they're racial identities, cultural identities, class identities, etc., etc., which we all bring with us. We all come from some sort of group identity. But as we move into the Sangha, we're trying to leave those behind and to operate together simply as members of the Sangha, as simply as fellow human beings, simply as individuals committed to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. If it's at all effective, and it's a big question how it is to be effective, it's not enough for it to be effective in its own terms, it has to be effective within society. It has to have an influence within the wider society. If it can do that, it can influence government. Quite interesting. I heard recently that the Indian government has been seeking out Buddhists to have a dialogue with. I don't know what's behind this and where that will go, and one is a little cautious, but perhaps there may be some opportunity. In Britain, there's much more outstanding opportunity insofar as mindfulness is popular at the moment, and it's seen in a secular way, and so people from many different sort of persuasions see it maybe as therapy, but it never can be just therapy, because implied in being mindful is a stepping away from your own conditioning. So there are opportunities in that sort of way. There's opportunities to influence through the media, which we're not particularly good at the moment, but letting the Sangha's voice be heard within the wider society, so that it's part of the discourse, part of the dialogue. The voice is to be heard. And then, of course, there's the hard slog of just trying to influence people, trying to open up possibilities for people one by one, by running a Buddhist centre in somewhere in London, so that people have the opportunity to make contact. Actually, I don't think we do it nearly enough in that way. London's a big city, it's a magnificent city at the moment. There's a huge possibility of influencing people from all over the world, of giving them a taste of the Dhamma that they can carry back to their own countries at some point, which I think we're not doing nearly enough. There's the chair. I think we should have a sort of presence in every borough of London, and at every level and of every entry point, we should have some influence. We're trying to present a Dhammic perspective, a moral perspective, a morality that is based on something more than merely humanistic values. Dr. Ambedkar famously said that Dhamma is morality, morality is Dhamma, but that morality must be sacred and universal. Universal in the sense of not belonging to a particular group. Sacred, it's a poetic term, to be taken as a poetic term, but meaning something like what I've been discussing, a sense of it going beyond the individual, the person, and having its roots in reality itself. So trying to communicate as many ways as we can, on as many levels as we can. That's the function of Sangha. Now, there's a great deal I should say at this point, but I'm running out of time, so I'm going to abbreviate what I was going to say. But I'll just give you a little bit of a preview of what might be said on another occasion. The duties of the Sangha, as a transformative agent within society, as a transformative agent that can influence the government, and can influence administration, can influence the voters, the electorate. First of all, of course, they've got to revere the Dhamma. that the Sangha should be the community that exemplifies reverence for the Dhamma, a community that is drawn together on the basis of the Dhamma as these sacred moral principles that go beyond the individual. That is first and foremost what the Dhamma is. Somebody was saying to me this morning that they worked in various situations, various intentional communities with strong ideals and so forth. But when they started to work in this context, there was something extra, another dimension, which they found it hard to put into words. But it is, I believe, this dimension of the Dhamma, this something that is not a something, that is greater than any of us as individuals, but that is realized in and through us as individuals. It's that which makes Sangha, rather than a good bunch of people doing something good out of sincere well-wishing. I'm not trying to belittle that at all. That's the first and foremost duty of the Sangha, is to try to live together on the basis of the Dhamma, so that the Dhamma wheel hovers above the spiritual community. And as I said yesterday, that's why we have the Dhamma wheel above the gate of the centre. So you walk in, well, you don't actually, but ideally, notionally, you walk through the gate of the Dhamma gate. The Dhamma Dvara. Then it should try to influence the wider society, individual by individual, on the basis of the Dhamma, trying to put people in contact with that spirit of the Dhamma, so that they experience it for themselves and they're supported in trying to live it out for themselves. And then, of course, there are those who themselves will wish to move into the Sangha more and more deeply, who will wish to leave a worldly life behind and live a life that is more and more based upon the Dhamma and less upon worldly values. So that the Sangha provides a framework for them so that they can move into it as far as they want to go. If they don't want to go very far, that's fine. But if they want to go very far, the opportunity is there. And then finally, yes, it offers an example of a community based on the Dhamma, a community which, in which the Dhamma is the principal influence, and that therefore sort of gives off a flavour, an atmosphere of the Dhamma, which, say, a centre like this, when it's at its best, it does. People walk into it, and they experience something that's different. They won't know quite how to identify it. They'll identify it with the way people relate or the atmosphere or something like that. But ultimately, it is the Dhamma. We don't always achieve it, of course. The Sangha is not a determinate body. Do you see what I mean? It's not that these are Sangha and these aren't. Sangha comes and goes. I know, because I'm supposed to be a member of it. And sometimes you're in it and sometimes you're not. Sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. Sometimes, I have to ashamed to admit, but it must be admitted, sometimes we squabble, like just, group members anywhere. It's true, isn't it? When we're all at our best, something more is there. When the Dhamma really is there amongst us, Sangha really comes into existence. Sangha is only there to the extent that the Dhamma is there. To the extent that everybody's revering the Dhamma, then our personal interests and our group identities, our old conditioning, becomes minimal. Vividly aware of this, because I operate within primarily the culture here, although I hardly understand that at all anymore, and the culture in India, which I'll never understand. But I'm sort of aware that I've got brothers and sisters in these two entirely different worlds. And of course, each of those is many, many different worlds. India is certainly not one world, and even dear old Britain is many, many worlds. People relate in India in such a different way. I now know and love the way in which people relate there. I remember when I first went there, I felt so lonely. I couldn't relate because, for instance, they didn't know a cynical joke. They didn't know our strange English self-deprecation, which is, of course, a form of self-assertion. And they just couldn't understand it. They just didn't understand our jokes. And I certainly didn't understand the things that made them laugh. And psychological analysis just didn't interest people. But I kind of know how to relate now, and I'm finding it more and more difficult how to relate here. But I'm a strange beast. I don't belong anywhere, which is fine. I love it. But what strong, strong experience right from the start that even though these people came from such different cultures, because we shared the Dhamma, we really were brothers and sisters as something tangible, not something notional, but something that was felt. So when you join the Sangha, you revere the Dhamma, you revere the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, and that joins you. And it unites you beyond what separates you. You leave behind what separates you. It's there. You know, I'll always be a white British, from a middle-class background, certain education, d'un certain âge, from a certain generation, and so forth. I'll always be that. I can't stop being it. But I'm not just that. That's a relatively peripheral aspect of what I am. And the same for every one of you. And because we revere the Dhamma, we meet beyond those personal conditionings. And indeed, they become something that enriches the Sangha rather than something that divides us as human beings. So the spiritual community, the Sangha, when it really is Sangha, offers an example of what society can be, what society could be. Perhaps never will be, in a certain sense, but it needs a constant leavening, needs a force that raises it beyond itself, that gives it a sense of something that transcends all the differences and divisions within society. So that's the primary function of Sangha, is to provide is to revere the Dhamma so that it can provide an example of what community is that is based upon the Dhamma, Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, to put it as we do usually put it, and to provide an opportunity for individuals who want to lead that kind of life to join, providing many, many channels through which they can engage themselves. I've got a diagram that needs quite a bit more explanation, but I'll show you it just because it makes the point. Oh, where's it gone? Some of you will be familiar with the schema of the levels of going for refuge. So the levels of reliance upon the Dhamma, you could say. There's what we call the cultural level of going for refuge, the cultural level of reliance on the Dhamma, which is, you don't get that so much in amongst us here, but in India it's very strong. But there are many, many people who are connected with our Sangha who are not committed, they're not meditating, they're not even thinking in those terms. They don't even know how to think in those terms. But they have a very, very good feeling about connecting with the Sangha. And they look up to the Sangha and they're influenced by it. It has a positive influence upon it. And I know that of the children of many of my friends. They have a very good feeling about the Dhamma. And when we can, we try to provide opportunities for them to connect more and more deeply with the Sangha. So that's what we call the positive group. It's a group. It's a group identity. They identify themselves as Buddhists, even in a sort of flag-waving sense. But the influence that plays upon them is a positive moral one. And it provides, therefore, the opportunity for them to, from time to time, commit themselves a bit more deeply. If they commit themselves a bit more deeply from time to time, that may become something that's more sustained, that becomes effective, which in our system is where you join the order, when you're able to sustain your commitment to the Dhamma. Eventually that becomes real, when you no longer are committed to the Dhamma. The Dhamma is sort of inside you. It's something that you are, not just something that you revere. So you have a sort of movement inwards that brings people from the wider society, who are largely functioning on a group identity. A group identity is one in which you think in terms of the survival of yourself and your fellow group members. You identify with that. Of course, it's never that simple, but as a crude distinction, it does. And you try to draw them into a positive connection. You know, for instance, people telling me about Lama's pajamas, that lots of people come into Lama's pajamas who are never going to become Buddhists. I mean, a lot of them are Muslims. And you're not trying to convert them or anything like that, but they have a positive sense. They like coming in there. And they say it. This is a bit different. The atmosphere is good here. I enjoy being here. You're all very nice, that sort of thing. They notice there's something a bit different. So they're drawn into a positive relationship, which gives them a good feeling, which helps them in their daily lives. My goodness, people often need that. They don't have a lot of it often, or some people don't. But anybody who wants to go further, you provide the outlets for them. So there's a movement inwards. But there has to be also this movement outwards. That the Sangha should be, as it were, channeling the Dhamma into the wider society, channeling it to try to influence those who do govern, trying to find ways of connecting with them so that they govern on Dhammic principles. You're not trying to dictate policy to them, because policy is a very complex matter, but you're trying to make sure that whatever they do, they do on the basis of moral principles. And if possible, even with some sense of something higher, something further, again, something that is not a something. And of course, you're trying to influence the wider citizen, trying to spread throughout society the moral principles that depend upon the Dhamma. Trying to do it in all sections of society. I think this is something, again, that we need to attend to. We tend always to attract people like us. And we always need to be increasing our range. It's quite natural. It's not conscious or deliberate. It's just obviously we speak a certain language, a certain way, and that appeals to people who speak in the same sort of way, who are the people like us. So we need to be extending our range. Quite consciously. I don't think it's something that just happens automatically. To some extent it may, but by and large you need to consciously reach out in different areas in different ways, because society is quite sectionalised, and we need to find more and more ways of doing so. So the Dhammarajya, if it is to come about again, comes about because of the influence of the Sangha. It's no longer possible to simply wait for the election of a Dhammachakra Pravartin Raja. It's not going to happen. It's very unlikely to happen. The people live in foolish hope and keep electing, you know, strong men and that sort of thing, because they think they're going to be Dhammachakra Pravartin Rajas, you could say, in a dim sort of way. That's what they're expecting. But I'm afraid they don't get it by and large. And not that there aren't good rulers and good politicians. I don't want to say that at all. But it's not going to happen unless there's a larger change in cultural outlook. I think this is needed more than ever, because I think democracy in the world is entering again a highly populist phase. I think when democracies first began to come about, it came about, you know, in the 19th century with high idealism. You know, you saw it, the labour movement, for instance, very, very high idealism. You know, you can't say inspired by the Dhamma, but certainly inspired by a sort of a sense of humanity that went beyond the merely individual. And that formed, to some extent, the democracy that we have. That you see the struggle for democracy in this country, and you see even more so in many other countries. That struggle is highly idealistic, often quite foolishly idealistic, and often with very little self-understanding, so that the ideals are sort of perverted by the individuals. But still, so much aspiration went into it. But once democracy sort of is established, and once a reasonable degree of equity is present within society, democracy very easily becomes simply competing interest groups. Competing interest groups who are able to capture, you know, the power of the press the influence, you know, what enormous money went into the Brexit campaigns, the campaigns about the referendum, and the distortion of lies that were spread around that very important decision, whatever you may think of it, one way or the other. I don't think the way in which it came about was a healthy way. That is the nature of democracy as it sort of reached its, once it's been achieved. You see the same in India. Independence was achieved with enormous idealism, and Indian democracy was a tremendous sort of achievement. And people I know who were around in the early days of independent India spoke about that sort of special kind of sense of solidarity, even in fragmented caste-based India, a sense that we were all sort of formed this new society. It lasted about 5 or 10 years. And then the shine goes off it. Just recently, I've been invited to a new state, which has just been formed with great aspiration, Telangana. And I met the people who formed this state. So much idealism. And I give them 3 years. The tarnish is going to come. Unless there is some sustaining influence that goes beyond it. And that, brothers and sisters, is our job. Is to actually live it and then to communicate it. And without that, what is there that can leaven this remarkable achievement, human achievement of democracy? What is there that can provide it with a depth and reach that it promised but cannot in itself fulfil? And when you see the way in which democracy is being subverted by populism, it makes me at least more vividly aware of the task of trying to inject moral principles into the public debate. That's all I've got time for. So much more to say, and maybe many more questions begged than answered. But nonetheless, principles, I hope, are a little bit clear and something to hang a debate upon has been fleshed out. So thank you very much. Thank you.